The reading tonight is taken from Luke's Gospel. It's chapter 24, verses 13 through to 35. And so it's titled in my Bible, On the Road to Emmaus. Now that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them. But they were kept from recognizing him. He asked them, What are you discussing together as you walk along? They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, Are you only a visitor to Jerusalem and do not know the things that have happened here in these days? What things, he asked. About Jesus of Nazareth, they replied. He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and the rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it is the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, but didn't find his body. They came and told us that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said. But him they did not see. He said to them, How foolish are you, how slow of heart, to believe all that the prophets had spoken. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. As they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus acted as if he was going further. But they urged him strongly, Stay with us, for it's nearly evening. The day's almost over. So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took the bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. They asked each other, Were not our hearts burning within us when he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us? They got up and returned at once to Jerusalem. There they found the 11 and those with them assembled together and saying, It is true. The Lord has appeared and risen and has appeared to Simon. Then the two told what had happened on the way and how Jesus was recognized by them when he broke the bread. This is the word of Christ. Thanks be to God.
Before I actually kind of launch into what I've prepared to say this evening, what I want you to do, I want to do a little bit of an experiment with you really. I want you to close your eyes. And I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. And I just want you to kind of see if you can enter yourself, immerse yourself in this story just for a couple of minutes. I won't drag it out, for too long. But I just want you to kind of imagine yourself in this story. So if you wouldn't mind just humoring me just for 2 minutes and closing your eyes. And I want you to start by just imagining your surroundings. You are one of these two that are on the road to Emmaus. So just look around you effectively, you know, what is your surrounding? What are your surroundings like? What's the weather like? What can you hear? What can you see? And I want to drop into this, what Jesus meant to you. Okay, you are one of two disciples. You have just seen this man crucified 2 days before. What did he mean to you? What had he been to you? Was he just a prophet? Was he a close friend? Was he somebody that held out so much more promise than just a friend? Was he like a father to you? What words come to mind that describe this person's relationship with Jesus? And now, once you've kind of got the idea of what Jesus meant to you as this person, start to ask yourself the question, what is it you're now feeling? You've witnessed his brutal execution. You have witnessed his burial. And you have been privy this morning to some odd news. What are you thinking? What does this mean to your life? And as you ask that question, then you can ask yourself the question, so what were these two people talking about on the road as they're traveling? What is it they think is going to happen now, perhaps? Is it all over? And it's into this situation that then a stranger appears and asks them, what's up? And says, are you so foolish? Okay, and the last question, I know I've rushed through this, but the last question is, how do you feel at the claim that you are foolish? Okay, you can open your eyes again. Hopefully, I'm sorry that it was a rush through. Normally you'd take quite a bit of time to lead through a meditation on that, but I just wanted you to kind of try and engage with some of the emotions that are behind such a familiar story as this. Most of us have heard the story of the road to Emmaus more than once. It is now familiar to us, and we kind of rush through it, and we don't necessarily engage with the real nitty-gritty of what's behind it. You see, here we have two people walking 7 miles through the Israeli afternoon on the first day of the week. They've been familiar with the teachings of Jesus, with his miracles, with the things that he said and the things he's done. They're familiar enough that they have formed the opinion, we're told, that he must surely be a prophet, powerful in word and deed, before God and all the people, it says. These two people have been present in Jerusalem. They've seen the events of a weekend. They've seen possibly the arrest. Probably not, because we're told that it's just the 11 disciples by then that go with Jesus to Gethsemane, but they may well have witnessed the trial in a kangaroo court. Trumped up charges. And then they witnessed the sentencing to death. The actual execution, maybe. And then the burial. They have remained in Jerusalem long enough to hear the most odd news of this morning. That the body has not only gone missing, but there are angels saying he has risen from the dead. Now these two were sufficiently part of Jesus' entourage that they refer to Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Mary the mother of James as some of our women. It says that in the passage that Christian read to us. Some of our women. They've been in the midst of the 11 apostles to hear news of these women, of what they've had to say this morning. But it's clear that when they later return to the 11, it's clear the fact that because they're returning to the 11, they're not part of the 11. So these are disciples, but they're not the disciples. In fact, we don't know who they were. Cleopas only occurs in this passage. We don't hear of him anywhere else. Was were the two, Cleopas and his wife? We don't know. But what we do know is that they were on the fringe of this entourage. They were close enough to the apostles that they knew them, that they went back to talk to them when this happened. They were close enough that the women that were part of this close circle were some of our women. Were they perhaps part of the 72 disciples that are sent out in chapter 10? The implicit suggestion of this text is that they were close enough to have been, but the truth is we really don't know. What we do know is they were close enough to know these things, and they were close enough for Jesus to deem them deserving or worthy or needy enough of a personal resurrection visit. Now, as I've pondered on this passage, the overriding question for me actually was, why did Jesus first choose to show himself to the women at the tomb and then to two people that weren't part of the inner circle? They were on the fringe. And I believe that actually this follows on from Roger's message this morning about the unexpectedness of Jesus and his actions. The 11 remaining disciples would, of course, have expected to have been the first to know, wouldn't they? They'd have been the first to expect to be privy to the Lord's plans, but in fact they weren't. God, even with the most important news, the defeat of death and the victory over sin by the one who has already revealed victory over everything else, sickness, the death of others, blindness, paralysis, leprosy, demon possession, hunger, victory over the elements by calming the storm or walking on water, God still chose to reveal it to people you wouldn't expect, and in a way that you wouldn't expect. But, because Roger discussed unexpectedness this morning, we're not going to go there. Instead, what I wanted to do was I wanted to look at why, even with the knowledge of Jesus' teaching and his power, even with all that understanding, that the hope was that Jesus was the one who was going to redeem Israel, but the disciples still didn't get it until things were explained. Okay, they knew all of this. And yet they still missed the point. Why? And I think there's two kind of possible ways in which this kind of misunderstanding happens. And I think if you'll bear with me, the first is a made-up story to try and illustrate this. So imagine a genetic engineer who doesn't get out much, and so he's been given the job to design a chimera, a hybrid animal that will be as comfortable on land as in the water. And so he sits down and he starts with his jotting pad and he starts to decide, well, what things would an animal need to do this? And so he designs the animal. He thinks, okay, well, if it's going to be comfortable on land and in water, it's going to have feet, but obviously being in water, swimming, maybe webbed feet, so it gives it webbed feet. It's going to be in water, but it might be out of water, so it needs to be able to kind of keep warm, but then keep cool, so I don't know, fur, feathers, maybe feathers, so it gives it feathers. But it's got to be able to, protect itself a bit. Its defenses will rely on it being able to see around itself a bit better, so maybe the eyes a bit higher up on the head would be a good idea. So it puts the eyes up on the head. And then he thinks, okay, he's got to be able to feed himself, he's going to be able to catch food and feed himself well, so he's going to have teeth. And so the genetic engineer designs the croco duck. Okay? Because that's how a man would design something that's got to live on water and land and feed itself. Because that's what men do. Left to our own devices, we make stuff fit what we want it to fit. We'll piece it together to make sense for us. Yeah? Hopefully this is kind of making sense. We don't necessarily piece it together in the right way. God designed a perfectly functional duck and a perfectly functional crocodile for completely different settings, but if we were given the design template, we'd make this. And so maybe the information that the disciples have been given all the way through Jesus' teaching have actually been pieced together wrong in their heads. Okay? In their heads, they've got the theological version of a croco duck. They've got all the facts about Jesus. They've got all the prophecies about Jesus. They've got all the teaching of Jesus, and yet still they kind of fitted it together wrong. Hopefully, that makes a bit of sense. But there is another way that I thought they might have misunderstood this. And the other way took my thoughts to a time long ago when I worked at Stansted Airport. I was one of the engineers who had the privilege to see the transition to the new control tower at Stansted. Now, Stansted Airport control tower is 60 metres high. They wouldn't let me abseil off the top, unfortunately, although I did try on several occasions. I asked, but they wouldn't let me. It's 60 metres high, and at the time it was the tallest control tower in Great Britain. Luton Airport, because of a quirk of land levels and height above sea level, they had the claim of being the highest control tower, but theirs was shorter. Unfortunately, of course, the argument's now moot because on the left is Stansted at 60 metres. Heathrow control tower now is 97 metres high. It sways in the wind like a daffodil, and I have the comfort of never having been in the top in high winds. But when we built the control tower at Stansted, the reason for it was so that our view of everything we needed to see would be uninterrupted. We would have practically perfect visibility over the entire airport. We could see everything that was going on. We could see all the aircraft. We could see all the vehicles. We had the complete picture. But there was a strange phenomena that we experienced within the first couple of weeks, actually, of being in the new control tower, which was fog. Fog isn't a strange phenomena when you're in it, but when you're in a control tower 60 metres above ground, fog looks different. Because as you will know, I'm sure, fog is low cloud. And so what we found ourselves was we were sat in a greenhouse above the cloud, looking down on the top of the cloud without a clue what was going on the ground. With the occasional interruption of a tailplane going through. And this is what made me think of it. So if you got the video lined up, can we? Not only is it one of my favourite films, but it illustrates what we saw from the top of the control tower very well. That's what we saw. We saw tailplanes cutting through. Now, we saw only a part of what was actually going on, even though we had an elevated position. Even though everything, the cleverness of civil engineers, the cleverness of my type of engineer, although probably not me, had provided everything we could possibly provide to have an elevated and informed view of what was going on around us. And yet still, our perception was clouded. Yeah, our perception was clouded. We didn't see everything. We could only see bits. Now, I asked you at the beginning to imagine what these two disciples, as an example, were thinking and feeling. The raft of emotions that these people were going through, and I wonder what you came up with. The words that I came up with were things like listless, incredulous, numb, lost, empty, shocked, bereaved, betrayed, disoriented, aimless, adrift, lonely, abandoned, afraid, disturbed, possibly even in danger. The understanding of the disciples was clouded by so many conflicting emotions and fears that despite their knowledge that Jesus had given them, despite their understanding deep down, they didn't get it. Okay? So the question is really, are we in either of those two camps this evening? Do we have an agenda that's made the facts fit, but not in the right way? Do we have such emotional turmoil that our understanding is clouded and all we can see is the occasional glimpse of what we want or need? So that's the first question, really. Either of those, you or me. So it's into this situation, though, that Jesus graciously walks. He doesn't roll his sleeves up and say, right, guys, for the last time, but rather he asks, what's the matter? Interestingly, he then effectively calls them fools, but I think that even before he starts to explain things, the authority that compelled people to listen to him originally would have captured their attention now. The risen Christ, I'm sure, had such authority about him that even though he said, are you so foolish? They possibly didn't take the offense that we might. Interestingly, as an aside, if we were hurt or scared or any of the other things I've suggested and someone drew alongside us and called us foolish, would we be as accepting as they are said to be? Or would we object to it? Would we not like being spoken to that way? Would we harden our hearts and not want to hear what they've got to say? But these disciples remained teachable, remained open to correction and direction and instruction. Anyway, Jesus gently shows them how everything that has been written about the Messiah has come to pass, and every promise he has made to them has been kept. If even death had failed to keep Jesus from the ones he loved, then there was no reason for them to have any doubt that every other promise he'd made, he would also keep. But here's the thing, Jesus will never force himself on anyone. He won't compel or bully, he won't cajole or bribe or blackmail. Jesus actually made to walk on in this story. He was going to continue his journey, and they had to ask him to stay. They requested he remain with them. In fact, we're told it was at their urging that he stayed to eat with them. They had every opportunity to allow him to continue on his way. After all, he'd suggested they were foolish, so they could have been forgiven if they said, well, we don't really want to invite him for tea. They could have been so wrapped up in their emotions, in their own feelings, that they overlooked the basic Hebrew expectation or requirement of hospitality. They could have accepted his first answer. The fact that they had to urge him suggests that he at least once went, no, that's all right, I'll keep going. They could have accepted his first answer. They had to urge him. And he declined the offer at least once, but he eventually stayed. They could have allowed him to just pass them by. They could have gone into their homes and continued to ponder the meaning of the weekend's events and never really known what they all meant. But they didn't. Here's the thing. Have we, because things haven't fitted our plans or fitted our understanding, have we, because things haven't fitted our expectations or our hopes, given up before the breaking of bread, before the meal, before the explanation, before the realization? Have we given up? Have we, due to the sheer volume of things in life, the emotions and the feelings and the obligations and the commitments and the fears and the worries, have we given up on God early? Have we found ourselves drifting? Maybe catching glimpses of the truth, just enough to keep us coming on a Sunday, but never really seeing the full picture. Have we allowed Jesus to pass by? Have we realized that we've had a chance and missed it, and feel in some way that that was our only chance, because it wasn't? Have we encountered Jesus on our journey through life, but felt that we needed to understand it all first, that we would invite you in, but I want to understand it all. I don't feel comfortable inviting you in until I know the answers to all my questions. Because the disciples had lots of questions. And they invited him in because of them, they didn't invite him in because of them. We have a baptism this evening. And we had two this morning. And the testimony of people who don't know it all yet, but have invited Christ into their lives to continue the dialogue was coming through. These were people that didn't have all the answers except the one important answer, Jesus Christ. After the baptism, there will be an opportunity for those who think they fit into any of those categories that I've said to give their life to Jesus, to invite him in, to come forward and receive prayer for any of the other issues, the emotional turmoil or anything else. But we are to remember that the resurrection of Jesus, as well as meaning that death and sin are defeated, as well as being a message of hope for everyone who accepts it, as well as being the call for all of Jesus' followers to live a resurrection life too, it is a clear statement by Jesus that he keeps every one of his promises. If he can keep a promise that death tries to cause him to break, then he will keep the promise to you to give you life and to give you life in all its fullness. The disciples that were walking the road to Emmaus could at any point have skipped the obligations of hospitality. They could have taken offense. They could have remained closed in their understanding of the events of the weekend. Let us take their example as something to follow. Let us welcome him in. Let us be challenged. Let us be called foolish if we are. But let us sit at the feet of Christ. Let us have bread broken by him. Let him change our lives. For I am convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future nor any powers, neither height nor depth nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord. May the Lord bless you and keep you and make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord turn his face towards you and smile and give you his peace tonight and always. Amen.